Xenoblade. Well, specifically, Chronicles X. Not just Xenoblade as a whole. We promised...
It's the spoil cast, people.
It's the Xenoblade. It's the Xenoblade Chronicles X cast. We promised this was coming, and we promised this was coming, and we also promised this was coming, and it is now here. So, if you have not played Xenoblade Chronicles X, or potentially Xenoblade Chronicles, we may deviate into some stuff there at some point. We're going to be pretty loose on conversation here. And you care about spoilers, because if you don't, then whatever, hang out. Let's talk. You might want to skip this one. Now, but if you don't, or if you have played it, this is it. This is our Xenoblade cast. This is Radio Free Nintendo. As you could probably surmise already, I'm joined by Guillaume, John, and Greg. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Guillaume.
I'm John.
Thank you, John. I hadn't noticed. Xenoblade. So, I want to start off first with a discussion about our feelings about the game. John and I talked a lot about Xenoblade Chronicles X when it came out, and we played a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles X.
Mm-hmm.
Guillaume and Greg spoke a little bit less about their feelings because we had already kind of decided we wanted to do the show at that point. So, I guess I'll start with Greg. Greg, you know, at a high level, what are your thoughts on this game?
Oh, I very much enjoyed it. Played it for a long time. I can't remember offhand the exact number of hours, but it was well over 100. I think it kind of met my expectations, really, having with the Japanese game having been out, you know, for months beforehand. You had Seren coming on and talking about it and stuff. You know, I wasn't expecting it to be, you know, that similar to the first Xenoblade for Wii, you know, in any real respects, you know, in terms of the story or anything like that. But, you know, just the exploration was kind of the thing I was hoping to get the most out of, and that is what I did get the most out of. I mean, I don't think I ever really got into the kind of the gear grind kind of part of it, which is really mostly for like the, you don't need that to clear the story, you know, but in terms of higher level, getting materials to build the best scales and all that kind of stuff, that's kind of where I dropped out. I kind of focused most on, you know, getting all the nodes, getting all the, as many of the sightseeing spots as I could. Although I think there's little bits in caves that have strange force fields for some reason. Very rare bits, but I'm assuming they're specific to a quest line that I never got to.
Yes.
But it was kind of a shock to encounter something like that in a game so open. We talked about that a lot. You know, if you want to go and swim all the way around, you can't, you know, just every now and then, like I think about twice I could think of, I just came across a cave that had a little pink sort of force field.
They are both tied to the same quest line.
Yeah, so that there wasn't really any explanation offered. You know, it's just there, that force field or whatever. But never mind. Anyway, like I said, the exploration in the most part was what I really enjoyed. Like I said, finding those sightseeing spots is really cool, especially when you feel like you've, you know, looked all over a particular segment of the map, and it's like, how am I missing this? I have a scale, I can fly anywhere, you know, and then you eventually find it like the hole in the giant sphere in Silverlim, and feel like an idiot for not seeing it sooner. You know, it's that all stuff was great, and so even though I probably didn't quite get all the way sucked into sort of every aspect of the game, like sort of the online stuff and, like I said, the material gathering and crafting and all that, I got far, far more than my money's worth out of it.
John, you and I have spoken a lot, but go ahead, give me your elevator review of Xenoblade Chronicles X.
Let's see. Okay, so Xenoblade Chronicles X, it combines a lot of the things that I really like in an RPG. It was sort of like a chocolate peanut butter kind of deal for me, right? Because I really like any game that has, I mean, I'm a big MMO guy, and the gameplay in this was very much MMO-like. So, I mean, I started playing and I was like, ah, this is exactly what I'm accustomed to doing. You know, getting quests, exploring the world. I really liked the way it had a large emphasis on exploring the world. I've always been a big fan of not so much anime in general, but more like mecha-based anime and that kind of stuff ever since I was a kid way back in the day. and so it definitely kind of scratched that itch, like with the skells and stuff like that. It gave you something. Not only did it give you something to look forward to, but the way they kind of just you know, dole them out to you over a very long period of time, but also tie it into exploring. I mean, it was really just, I found it really rewarding, like that style of gameplay. Probably not for everybody, but I really like exploring large worlds, like large MMO style worlds like that. And the reward that I got for doing that, I really, really enjoyed getting. Like, I really enjoyed flying around with the Skell and all the different Skell gear and stuff like that, and, you know, kind of figuring out the crafting and stuff like that, and, you know, building up the, you know, the gear companies and all that kind of stuff. It was really cool. I enjoyed it a lot. Played the hell out of it.
Cool. Yeah, you did. Yep. I actually have a remarkably high tolerance for things I classify as dumb anime bullshit.
Yeah.
And to some degree, actually sort of find myself drawn to the dumber the better anime bullshit. Like, if you can show me a Gundam series where things are just stupid from the beginning and get dumber as things go, and I've got a series in mind, and I'm not going to name it because there are people who really defend that series because they're stupid. it's the dumbest thing I've ever seen, but I love it because it's so remarkably idiotic.
Yeah.
And this game sort of has that to some degree, although it toys with higher mindedness in a lot of ways.
Mm. It really only toys with it. Like, well, a cat would play with the...
I am choosing my words very carefully, Guillaume.
Mm-hmm.
But at a larger point, I just sort of liked the feeling. We're going to talk about the story a lot, and the story is relatively thin. I liked that there's this world that you're building out through quests and through these interactions with the people in the world. I thought some of the Deus Ex Machina, in some cases quite literally, was ridiculous and dumb, and in maybe not in the good dumb. But what I did enjoy was this sort of, as you're exploring the world, there's sort of this persistent sense of dread. And it's not just you and the environment that you're fighting, because you are constantly dealing with things that can eat you. But there's also the sort of the global level sense of dread where, you know, the town right now is full of aliens that are dangerous, or things are under attack, or there's an enemy somewhere on this planet that we basically, every time we encounter them, are just barely staving them off.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a big kind of
exactly, the doomsday counter, literally, Majora's masking the whole damn thing.
Yeah. We will die in this long.
Yes, like, there's this sense of just like, hey, shit is very, very much real right now, and you very much need to deal with it. But at the same time, I did a quest line where I delivered pizza.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay. To a guy that says, you know, who starts screaming things like, deploy that pizza.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk more about him a little bit later, I suspect. But, like, exploration mechanics, I loved all that stuff, but I just liked that kind of world.
Mm-hmm.
Guillaume, you've really played your cards close to the, I mean, not really, but you sort of said we're going to hold it for this. I'm giving you,
right.
You are free to just go.
Right. Well, I think that a lot of what I'm going to mention in passing, we're going to delve into a little bit more deeply. I've already said on the podcast that a lot of things disappointed me about Xenoblade Chronicles X. I was hoping that the game would have more streamlined menus, or would be more user friendly in its various menus and stuff than Xenoblade Chronicles was. And turns out that no, it really isn't. Like, they did take steps with the user interface that make some things a little bit better, but there's a thousand other ways where they made the game just as bad or even worse, you know. Like the affinity quests. Affinity back in Xenoblade Chronicles was just a matter of fighting a lot with the same people. You know, and maybe, like, you could get into, like, little mini-games, like, giving them gifts or whatever, completely optional. But building affinity was, you know, this a very simple affair. Here, not only do you have to fight with them a lot, but you have to do these affinity quests. You have to have a certain affinity level with them before you can start these affinity quests. You have to find them on the map before you can even start anything, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes they won't appear until a certain time of day.
Yeah, so that's really annoying. And, yep, you know, like, you've got this item, the follow ball, which could have solved everything, right? Like, usually it will point you towards your next objective if you've started a mission. They could easily have had it just show you the way to the next person that you want to talk to. You know, you select you know, someone in a list and it just guides you to them, and everything would have been so much simple. Or just show them on the map. It's not that hard. But yeah, so the game was kind of, I don't know, there's a lot of things that were made wastes of time that could have been made much simpler. And a lot of times I just didn't want to deal with them. So I skipped I didn't do a whole lot of the Affinity missions. And yeah, like there's, you know, just like everyone else, I liked the exploration, quote unquote, because the world is really cool looking. The world that they built, Mira is really cool. It's a nice, it's, you know, some areas are more imaginative than others, but still, like, as a whole, like, I've never really seen anything like that in a video game, so I really enjoyed just scouring it. But at the same time, did I need to play the game for 100 hours before, you know, to do that? Probably not. There was a lot of that was kind of, you know, padding or grinding or things like that. So, yeah. And there's more reasons that I did not enjoy it fully that we're going to get into pretty soon. Like the way that, yeah, like it kind of tried to toy with some heady themes, except that it didn't really. It would touch on them and then get bored and move on to something else.
So we actually have an email from Isaac, kind of speaks to this. He starts out that Guillaume has asserted that Xenoblade Chronicles X is a slog to play through.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, I agree. I'm speaking as Isaac, not as myself. The game for me was a disaster. I'd been following the game rapidly for 3 years, ever since the first announcement trailer was shown at a Nintendo Direct in 2013. And that trailer was for me personally, robots. There were mechs. And I was like, all right, I'm in. But anyway, however, when I received the game, everything was about as bad as it could be. Everything I loved from the first game was gone. The deep, philosophical, and reaching story was replaced with a direct-to-DVD anime plot, which never seemed more planned out than a rough draft on the back of a napkin. The music? Well, it was better suited to Akihabara, in my opinion, than on an alien world. I hate to be so negative, but I was really expecting something different. The first Xenoblade was something special, and it was my favorite game of all time. To have it change so dramatically was really unfortunate. I ended up selling it after 12 hours. Don't get me wrong. The gameplay and world were amazing. Some of the best, if not the best, that I've ever seen in a JRPG. Mira is an amazing place to explore and conquer, and the battles were fluid masterpieces. However, as a story-focused gamer, I found the lack of a good story a deal-breaker.
Yeah, you're not going to find a great story here, I don't think.
I think what you find more is the story of a world. You don't find you get the stupid plot twists that you got from the original Xenoblade.
Sure, fact, you, but you could see them coming a mile away.
So yeah. you could see
there's
that
there's quite a lot of stuff that's telegraphed. Quite a lot. I mean, the obviously the reveal of Elmer at the end is heavily telegraphed. Like that.
It
almost seems kind of pointless because she's clearly suggested that, you know, oh, you're going to be in for a surprise when you see what my body looks like and all
but
that.
But I think the, if you didn't get it spoiled, the Mimeosome thing, like, it answers a lot of really dumb mechanical questions you had about the game early on. Like, why the fuck can I jump off giant buildings?
I like that. I think there's some conceptually pretty sound stuff in terms of that goes into just the nature of the game. Like, yeah, the fact that, you know, your characters are kind of robots, and that's why, you know, you can customize your character. And then when there's a part in the game later on where you can actually go back and revise the design for your character because it's a robot.
Who cares?
So, you know, it's that's pretty sort of cool, and the way it all sort of ties into the systems of the game and all that. It is more the narrative where it's not so strong,
right? I think
of that's by design. I mean, I think it's just the kind of game they were making. I mean, I think this is part of the problem of calling it Xenoblade Chronicles X or Cross or whatever. You know, like. When it's no more related to the Wii game than the Wii game was to some of the other Xeno branded games that Takahashi's made over the years. You know, that there's obviously, yes, there's similarities with the battle system and you know, the aesthetic to some extent, you know, the sort of, the way the faces are drawn and stuff. Although obviously the, it's got a lot more sort of graphical horsepower to work with. Now on Wii U, but you know, it's not related. I think that's well, that's the problem. To the Isaac sort of you know, complaints is that, you know, clearly when you brand something like that, there are going to be people who are expecting it to be more of a successor to that game than this was.
Well, not even I wasn't even looking for consistency with the previous game. I kind of expected it to just be a quote unquote spiritual sequel or just, you know, made by the same people. You expect some themes to come back, but I was not expecting Xenoblade 2. Otherwise, it would have been called Xenoblade 2, probably. But even, like, I was trying to find, I would have liked some consistency within the game itself, you know, because the game is simultaneously kind of throwing ideas at you all the time, and then it abandons them, and also it ignores them actively while you're playing.
You know? Yes.
I'm thinking, like, of the very beginning, when you are waken up by Elma, she's just like, oh, my mission is to find people, to find pods. So I found you. Oh, you've lost your memory. That's too bad. Let me explain everything to you. And now can you help me find more stuff? And I'm thinking, yes, that sounds cool. I'm going to have a reason to explore this world. And this reason is I'm going to be rescuing people out of pods. Well, no, that never happens. It would have been good, though, you know, like instead of finding these little chests everywhere that are absolutely, you don't, there's no story reason really for that. You know, like you search like kind of a wrecked car and you have no idea how it got there in the first place. And you find some probes. What does that even do there? You know, it would have been more engaging to be actually rebuilding Mira person by person.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, there's stuff in the game that is obviously just overlaid game mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they give you this, like, this speech about, oh, you know, like, we've got to coexist peacefully with the fauna of this planet. We're not going to repeat the same mistakes as on Earth. And then that's just, like, whatever. The game doesn't give a shit, you know?
Yeah, it's like, constantly level 90, let's kill it.
Yeah, exactly. You're constantly killing creatures, and they're not always constantly aggro, but several times you'll have missions like, well, we need this part for our espresso machine, so go kill this many of these creatures.
Yeah, and even more so than that, you know, to advance the story, you need to complete parts of the map, and completing parts of the map is helped by killing the monsters in the different map areas.
Yeah, particular. Yeah,
well, so it actually encourages you to kill the fauna.
In those cases, they kind of try to hand wave it away by saying, oh, well, these creatures are so big and terrifying that they're a threat to us. But it's just, I don't know. It's not very convincing at all.
They're like every 10 square feet, there's another creature that you have to kill.
It's interesting what you say about the bit at the start, because I kind of felt a similar way. Like, oh, yeah, you know, are people going to come into the party that are like you, but presumably without the amnesia? You know, but they would be people you would find just out in the world.
Right.
But of course, that doesn't really kind of occur. But then I guess there is some kind of this hints at what's going on.
Right.
Why that part of the story doesn't add up. Like, it kind of suggests reasons for that, doesn't it?
Well, so Shosan, the man who's slowly turning himself into dictator, at some point, more or less explicitly says to Elma, like, yeah, we knew that there weren't more people on that trip that you were going to rescue. Like, we knew all those pods were effed. So, but they went, didn't they, I think at the beginning, they announced on the news that Elma rescued, like, 7 people?
Yep.
And there was only one?
Yep.
Right.
Which, and of course, they'd already been on the planet, what, 3 months at that point?
Yeah.
So presumably they had gotten to all the easy people that they had found. So
you're literally next door, though.
Yeah, I know.
Surrounded by low-level enemies.
Yeah. Well, and there is a weird, there's a very strange.
Well, and also just the fact that, you know, the whole thing of, like, all the people are meant to be, you know, sort of members of the ship, the crew members of the ship, and all that, but nobody seems to know who you are. I think, you know, that it's. I don't think it's so much a hole in the plot, but it's just something they never fully get into.
Well,
yeah, well, well, I'm willing to allow that, but then again, I don't know. There's too much. Like, so, yeah, the thing with the destroying the fauna thing bothered me more.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, like I said, well, I mean, clearly,
have you seen those things? They need to die. Yeah. They are hideous.
I mean, clearly, that you get to a point where it's like, well, you know, what's been told to the people is not, you know, entirely truthful, or what's sort of going on. Even though it's not like, oh, the government, or you know, what semblance of government there is evil or anything. It's not that kind of story.
It's lying for utilitarian. Yeah, it did seem like they were setting up Chausson to be a bad dude.
Yeah, it seemed like Chausson was going to be more evil, or, you know, like more sort of, you know, bad in general, perhaps, than he turned out to be. He was just sort of a bit suspicious, and then it never really sort of came to anything. But in terms of, like, your character, it just kind of, there's a certain amount of suggestion that, you know, they might know more about who you are than you do, you know, like they perhaps you're some sort of experiment or something, you know, like there's
two main points that really jump out at me on this one. Oh, three, I guess. One, right after you're rescued, Chausson, basically, if you decline him over and over again, he basically just, he shames you endlessly about it.
Right.
But you find out that they had already signed you up to join the squad specifically of the alien who brought all the technology to Earth before you had even registered, before you had picked what group you want to be in, before you had done anything. They'd already signed you up for her, even though they thought she rescued 7 people, which is weird. Late in the game, after you do everything, there's sort of a nod between the major players in Blade and the administration of like, yeah, we did a good job on this one. And then if you'd played the little side stories that for the partial characters, one of the DLC characters, so not even a character that's in the base game, if you were in Japan, Yelv, his side story is very strange. So Yelv doesn't have memory either. Yelv was rescued late after the ship, well after the ship crashed. The only thing he really remembers is his time back on Earth in the military with his buddy, whom he is trying to find. And most of his side quests revolve around you finding pieces of his buddy's body, his mimeosome.
Wow.
So, A, the question of why was Yelv in cryostasis if he was part of the security of the crew? But B, why is the only thing he really remembers his buddy and nothing else? And in his case, Eleonora basically goes from being essentially assigning you tasks to being alive and like having interaction with him. And like at first it feels like she's got the hots for him or something. Like she's giving him movies to watch and trying to give him cultural tips and whatever. And then at the very end of his story arc, they show another one of him in the Mimeosome Maintenance Center in a pod asleep. And you realize, oh shit, Yelv is a robot. Yelv is not a Mimeosome. Yelv is a fake person created explicitly to do security with fake memories. And which is weird because Eleonora seems very insistent on you and Yelv working together. It's like, oh, maybe the cross character is the same thing, or maybe the cross character is a more advanced version of him. Like, what is this? Why?
Yeah, I mean, you got the sort of obvious kind of Blade Runner kind of parallel there, haven't you, in terms of the sort of the robots that know they're robots, and then the ones that have memories implanted to make them seem more human and all that kind of stuff. Like, and so whereas you might be a sort of blank slate creation with him, they were trying to create so he would actually think they were a person, you know, and think they knew who they were and that kind of stuff. So it's you know, it's a very obvious kind of thing to toy with, being that you've got all these sort of synthetic bodies, a Blade Runner type of theme. But it again, it sort of toys with it. Go back to that, you know. Yeah. It does. I mean, there are loads of side characters, as James said. This is something that was additional in Japan.
And he's the hardest character to find, except for what's her name? The one that you give the gear to at the very beginning.
God, yeah.
Because like you basically have to just find her in the world.
Oh, Mia?
Yeah. She's the hardest.
Yeah.
Like almost impossible, unless you have a guide. But yeah, I mean he's hiding behind two buildings. Like you can totally pass him all day long and not know he's there. And he's so insufferable. Like you're like, why am I gonna hang out with him? And I just hang out with him because he's a psycho disruptor with a beam weapon. And I'm like, that sounds like a cool combo. And like that's the only reason I had his ass around. But
that's the thing. I mean, you've got all loads of side characters, as people have often said, you know, you've pretty well encouraged to keep Elm and Lin in the team at all times. You've yep. kind of got one spot open. A lot of people, even with the Western release, are not necessarily going to come across this stuff, but it's probably like some of the most important for, you know, they were never going to find more people like you out there because you're some sort of weird experiment that they're running.
Right. Like the darkest way of reading that is the reason they haven't been finding more people for a while and then they suddenly found you right next to the ship is you were fucking put there.
Yeah, you're a plan, you're an experiment, and you know they I guess you know the whole sort of conceit is the idea that you know these were real living breathing people on Earth, but then their consciousness being carried around inside robotic bodies. And they experimented by saying, well, what happens if we just have a robotic body and kind of let it go? Like, how much of a person is that?
Well, you know, and
like that kind of thing.
Jumping to the end, and we're talking about the themes it toys with, the idea of what makes you a person. So the lies inside of lies. Like, I don't think they ever lied to Cross and didn't tell that character that, oh, by the way, you're a robot. You're not a robot. Don't worry about it. Like, they just never – it never occurred to them to mention it for some reason. Because
yeah, that's the way it sort of explains, like, well, you know, your arm gets chopped off and that's the reveal is that, you know, it's a robotic arm. And then, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, we didn't.
We're all robots here.
We didn't realize that you'd be shocked by that kind of thing. Like,
because it's like, we're all robots. But again, the idea that if Cross knows nothing, essentially it's just an AI with no memory, then it would be surprising. But the idea that it rolls, what they told all the people was, oh, your bodies are in cryostasis on the Ark. Don't worry about it. It's the life hold. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And then when you get there, of course, the finalist reveal or the second finalist reveal is that they're not. The bodies died on Earth. We just put a bunch of protoplasm in a jar with DNA synthesizers and said, all right,
the idea that they've preserved the memories, you know, and now they're in robotic bodies, but then they're just going to kind of rebuild their genetic bodies with this sort of storage of information and then transfer them to those instead eventually. So I guess they could, you know, procreate and go on that way.
Right. The answer they give to that being, well, we did that because imagine how many cryosleep bodies you could fit in. Now imagine how many bodies of just DNA data you can keep. It's like, okay, well, that makes sense, but why did you lie to everybody? Well, they wouldn't agree to it otherwise. Well, yeah, of course they wouldn't agree to it.
Yeah, that's because it's the whole kind of thing of like, well, is it really you? Or is it just kind of a clone with software running on it or whatever? You know, that whole thing. Again, it's that whole thing about what does it mean to be human and all that. And I mean, there's I guess for me, the one sort of thing that came across with the narrative themes is that if you cast your mind back to Monolith's undisputed action adventure opus Disaster Day Crisis,
mean storytelling marvel
that had that came out in 2008, I think, but in the
something
end
like that,
it got delayed a lot, but it had all these references to like late 90s action movies. It was kind of like 10 years behind. You know, but with this it feels like it's sort of about 10 years previous TV that it's really short. You know, there's a lot of, to me, the Battlestar Galactica kind of reboot and Lost about this, if you sort of mash them together, you know, because the primary struggle ends up being, you know, the people that are trying to exterminate the humans are sort of synthetic life forms that were created by the distant ancestors of humans and all that. I mean, that's very Battlestar reboot, although, you know, none of the Cylons had that weird sort of toad throat thing going on.
No!
But, you know, like, that Luxar does, but, you know, the weirdness of the planet Mira, this miracle planet, you know, as definite sort of tie-ins with the island in Lost, you know. There's stuff there that they never, you know, explain, you know, I mean, in terms of there's a sort of mystery about, well, how can we all talk to each other? We shouldn't be able to talk to each other, but we can. And then the ultimate reveal is way bigger than that, isn't it? It's just like, well, the mechanism we thought was keeping alive has been destroyed all the time. So what the hell's going on? And then, you know, I mean, you're presumably never going to find out because...
But is it just me, or are they really quick to blame the planet for anything mysterious that's happening? Because at some point, like, they...
They're stuck on a different planet, Guillaume.
Yeah, I know.
Whole different planet, yeah.
But at some point, like, there's not foreshadowing. They flat out say, like, hey, how come we can even use these mimeosomes? Because if our bodies are, you know, miles away in this pod, there should be lag input.
Right. Yeah, and how can we understand each other if we're all different species?
Right.
And,
but the lag input thing, you know, then someone says, like, oh, it's probably the planet, you know? Yeah. And then turns out that they were they were wrong. Like, it was not that...
Yeah, it was more drastic than that.
Right, it was more drastic. So, but, like, why would you even say that? Well, oh, it's probably the planet. Why couldn't it be, probably our bodies are closer than we think, or...
And Elma throws that out very quickly after as a response. Like, well, it probably just means they're close. And they weren't close at all. They were, like, really far away.
Yeah, not surprisingly. Otherwise, you know, you could...
They would have found them.
Yeah,
but what's interesting to me about that whole exchange is the quickness with which she threw it out. Like, she's trying to change the subject. Like, let's not have this conversation right now. This is not something I want to talk about.
Hmm.
But it does make me wonder, even going back further about what's going on here. So we're introduced to the game by Lynn basically monologuing about this war that we find out later. The reason that Earth was prepared for it at all, insofar as you could say they were prepared, is that Elma showed up and's like, dude, things are going to get real bad here real soon. Mm-hmm. You need to go. Which, of course, raises the question of how did she know so far ahead of time that things were going to get nasty? But we see Luxar and Co., the Ganglion, and we see this other, almost look like energy creatures that they're fighting. Like, their ships are very different, these purple neon things. And they both are responsible for destroying Earth. It's not a one-way deal. But it's not Luxar and Co. that shoot down the Lifehold. It's this other group that then just pieces out. Which is weird, because basically they said the whole time, nobody can leave Mira. Like, we just can't get off this stupid planet.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And there's a whole thing about, like, with the whole Back to the Future Professor B storyline.
Yeah.
Those quests are about, there's this space-time anomaly around the planet, and, you know, the all this kind of stuff. I was kind of wondering whether they were going to go full Paradox on it, like, you know, the humans that are there eventually sort of go on to become the people that created the Ganglion or something like that, you know.
That would be a very Xenoblade Chronicles ending.
Yeah, you know, right. Something like that just seemed like it might have been on the cards. But again, I mean, the game just kind of ends, and I guess to some extent it has to leave things open because it's
right.
Kind of, well, the idea is that you don't just stop playing once the plot is achieved, you know, so... You know, I guess it's kind of strange that there's some of these threads in there that they must have known they'd never resolve, because they don't really do direct sequels, Monolith, you know, very often. I guess there was the Bat and Kaito's prequel.
Which actually does a really nice job tying up loose ends, which you think would be difficult in a prequel, but they actually do a pretty good job of sort of like answering some of the mysteries of Bat and Kaito's, which it does leave you with some stuff where you're like, okay, why? Why is it like that? Why is it here? And they do a good job of sort of tying you back into that. Now, one other thing is that the people who produce this game have said that the reason it's kind of light on story is because they were treating it as a sort of experiment for making an HD game. You know, they'd never made one. Nobody at Nintendo had really done an HD game like this before.
Yeah, at this scale.
And they had to make a lot of tech. And a lot of that tech ended up in other games. And that
Zelda Wii U,
I'm sure. And they said they want to sort of merge Xenoblade Chronicles with Xenoblade Chronicles X in their next endeavor. A game that's more story-driven, more focused. People have misinterpreted that and saying he wants to make a Xenoblade Chronicles X sequel with a more story-driven plot. I'm not sure how you could, though, because they've sort of... How you've wound all your mysteries together. The only thing that I really want an answer to at that point is, who were the aliens that downed you on Mira?
Mm-hmm.
And why did they pick Mira? How did they know that planet was that jacked up? And B, who is it that essentially, not rescues, but finds, what's his name?
Lau,
at the very end, the guy in the cloak. Who is that? Because that is a person that has not been, like, who is just showing up out of nowhere at this point and knows that Lau's gonna wash up on that beach. Especially when everybody thought Lau's body was destroyed. And also, don't they sort of imply that Lau's body is real, not mimeosome at that point?
Right.
So, and also, I guess
when he opens his eyes, he's still got the weird looking iris though.
Oh, maybe,
because again, that's to be fair, like when we talk about them kind of telegraphing stuff, they do show you the weird looking iris before you're ever told you're a robot,
right? And people were making fun of especially Lynn in the lead up to the game, because her eyes are completely freaky looking, and people just thought it was just bad faces, because if you remember, Xenoblade Chronicles had bad faces.
Yes.
Really, really bad faces, and we just assumed it was that. But you bring up Professor B, which is interesting. Because his questline is funny. There is a lot of comedy in this game that we haven't talked about, but his is particularly amusing to me.
And it's mostly in the side quests. I mean, that's the side quests that, you know, not affinity quests, but, you know, just kind of normal kind of quests that you'll get from characters. There might be one that you need to check off that section of the map or something like that. They have quite a big range of tone. You know, like some of that deals with the most sort of serious or quite dark material in the whole story. You know, I mean, the one about the water reservoir is shocking. The places that goes.
Is that the one about cannibalism? There's the one about cannibalism, I think.
No, that's the one about the parasites. There's like a parasite that takes over your body and essentially.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yep.
Yeah, that's the one where basically the whole quest line for 2/3 of it is just there are two female doctors who are essentially building the water reservoir for the planet, and one's hyper jealous of the other. Mm-hmm. Like, that's basically the whole plot line, and then suddenly, oh shit, monsters, everybody's dead. and what's weird is, as you find these alien races, which you can totally miss, one of them, I'm blanking on which one it is, the ones that look like the Orphe, there is a quest line in the Orphe where essentially they're like, hey, that thing that happened, that was real fucked up, wasn't it? You know, we probably could have prevented that with these weapons if you helped us find stuff for it. And then they just arm the water reservoir and nobody says anything else about it.
It's like, right.
It's like, no, thanks, but guys. I think you were helpful.
For me, I guess the way it went was that the first few of the normal missions that I did had more of a comedic kind of bent to them, you know, whether it was about the coffee, you know, the clumsy girl and the coffee machine, or the pizza, or all that. Mm-hmm. So you kind of feel like, okay, yeah, the ones that are going to be told just in text are not going to be as dramatic. They're going to be kind of goofy, all right. And there are lots of those, and Professor B's are some of those. But then you get the stuff about, you know, the kind of religious zealotry and the xenophobia. It's like, I was not expecting this stuff to be dealt with.
Actually, about that specifically, Paul wrote us, as I've been drawing on my experiences from Xenoblade Chronicles X, I wondered what you guys thought about the portrayals of racial politics. Many of the game's side quests have a lot of on their mind regarding one race's attitude towards another in New LA. Notably, the Murder Most Foul quest with members with the murders by pizza, the Alex subplot, the late game tree clan, cavern clan prone stuff. Do you think the portrayal of these issues lands in a game like this, or is the portrayal flattened by the sometimes loose storytelling?
It seems out of place.
Yeah, the Murder Most Foul thing is probably the most shocking thing that you see at some point, like in the game, because it's triggered not even by you talking to anyone, but just by walking between two buildings.
Right.
And so you go, you're just walking, minding your own business, and all of a sudden, oh, okay, a cutscene. And then all of a sudden, like a Manon falls flat on the ground from a high building. And, oh, what the hell was that? You know? And it starts this whole quest about you trying to solve this murder. And, it does lead to some of the more interesting.
It turns into a detective game briefly.
It does, yes. And I don't know, like I did enjoy that element, and that's the thing about the game, right? Like, I didn't play 100 hours, you know, completely bored and wanting to stop, because I would have stopped earlier. Like, there were elements like A Murder Most Foul that really kept my interest. But ultimately, yeah, I think that Paul already answers his own question when he asks, you know, like, he's just asking a question. Does the portrayal of these issues land in the game, or doesn't that quite reach the heights that it seems to want to reach?
It seems strangely dark for such a lighthearted game.
Is it a lighthearted game? Because 6.1 billion people died in the first 30 seconds.
Yeah, but that's kind of preamble setup stuff, though. Like,
yeah, it is. And also, notice how no one in New LA seems to give a shit
Oh, they do.
They kind of do, but they're also drinking lattes.
Yeah,
and they seem pretty happy about it.
Yep. The cultural stuff, you know, like there's lots of very sort of frivolous cultural stuff that again they sort of try to weave into the kind of build the world up through, you know, the text based kind of normal missions like trading cards and all sorts of silly things.
Well, I mean, they have currency, but they don't have any trade partners. So why do we even need currency, really?
That's one thing I wanted to touch on.
Why do I need to earn money?
Yeah, well, it doesn't make sense. The whole concept of blades really doesn't make sense because, okay, so you're going to work to rebuild to rebuild Earth or to create this place where you're going to live for the rest of your life, possibly. Like, okay, it makes sense. Like, you're survivors, you're putting your collective effort, you know, putting in the collective effort to make this place inhabitable. And that's, you know, there's value. And like all these blades have these different roles. And again, like they've got value. They're doing something good for the good of mankind. Right. But then you still got like the Starbucks like chains of coffee places. Like I don't know.
It's nostalgia.
They do try to hand wave it away by saying like, oh, well, these robot bodies that we have don't actually need coffee, but they enjoy coffee.
There's so much chat about food in the game in particular.
There is.
And then you've got robot bodies. It seems like a hell of a waste of time just for the sake of some sort of comforting kind of nostalgia.
I think their wave away is like, we felt like it would be psychologically destructive if your robot body didn't feel like having a human body. So we...
Right. They're not acting like people who are just enjoying everyday comforts in robot bodies. Like, I don't know what that looks like, but I'm saying that's not what it looks like.
No.
But also, they're not acting like people traumatized by their planet having just been blown up and everyone they've known and loved.
Well, basically, Lao is the only person that...
He is, and that's at the very end of the game on Chapter 12. Like, finally, you get someone reacting.
But, I mean, his behavior throughout the game is...
It's the first time in the game that someone expresses this, whereas like while I was playing the game it had been 100 hours that I was like, what the fuck is wrong with these people?
Well, there is a quest line, it's a long one too, it's got a bunch of chapters on it, where you're investigating essentially things keep happening to, so as the town develops and you do these quests to bring in, you know, these aliens, and essentially you're liberating them from the ganglion and bringing them on board. A lot of they sort of change as you interact with them, which I really like. The Orphei especially,
true,
where suddenly because the Orphei are around humans, they're Ova. They're sort of like spirit inside them decides, this gender thing looks cool, let's try that. And suddenly they have to come to grips with having another gender and like having weird psychology of like, why am I attracted to that one? Which seems a totally unnecessary thing when they, you know, they essentially reproduce by dividing their body. But there's after you've brought enough of the aliens in, the Xenos as they refer to them, there is a quest line that starts up where things start happening. And in some cases, it's like a Manon's getting hassled by a group of people. In some cases, it's like an Orphei is killed. And you're constantly pursuing whatever is responsible for this and never... And either you catch them and just drive them off, or you get there, it's too late or whatever. And ultimately what it comes down to is one of the blades responsible for peace and security in town. One of the, I can't remember what the term they use for that group of blades is. But like one of the senior ones responsible for maintaining security in town is actually running essentially a militia that is at night killing Xenos.
Yep.
Right.
And it's like, whoa. Cause their explanation isn't just like they took, you know, they took our gerbs. It's basically like straight up, these people are responsible for Earth's destruction. They need to die. And you're like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, I found that whole quest line disturbing. I was like,
well, I think that was the intention, though.
Yeah, especially the part where you fight, you kind of track that group down up onto like the high plateau, and you kind of walk up and there's a bunch of...
You've driven them out of town.
Yeah, and you walk up to them and there's a bunch of dead bodies there. Like, it's the one where like they say, hey, go rescue these three Manons, I think, and go find them and rescue them from these guys. And you walk up and they're all dead. And I'm like, That's kind of creepy. That's not really what I expected from this game.
At the same time, it's a little bit convenient that it's just confined to these missions. Because, you know, like, you don't get the feeling that it's a new LA-wide phenomenon, you know, this resentment. It's this convenient thing where just a group of bad apples that are easily dispatched have been doing this, you know, and you go after them and then you solve the problem. Sometimes you'll have like, oh, this shop owner doesn't want Manon shopping at her lingerie store or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, I think that's an actual example.
It's the one where you have to get the necklace, I think, isn't it?
Like, right.
It's outside the jewelry store.
So you get a trinket, you go across the world to get a trinket, you give it to her, and like, oh, I guess the Manon are not so bad after all. Mm-hmm. Because I like this one here. She you know, like, they really don't go very deep into issues of racism or xenophobia and anything like that. It's all too compartmentalized and too convenient and, you know, kind of black and white.
Yeah, it's kind of like
most of the
time. If you're going to go there, really go there. Don't just go there superficially.
I would argue that the trouble with going there, and this may be a little bit of having their hand stayed a bit by their corporate overlords, is that in this specific instance, the correct answer probably shouldn't be, man, all racism is bad.
Yeah.
Because the correct answer should be, you know, maybe it's okay to be standoffish right away, because, you know, some of these aliens that are now in your town built the technology that the Ganglion used to blow up Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe so it may be hard to give the message of, you know, sometimes racism's not quite as bad as we make it out to be.
Okay, but maybe make it a little bit more organic than that. Don't have like, oh, okay, so I met this alien race, so let me talk to my boss, and the boss is all like, yeah, sure, let's have them inside our walls, and let's trade technology with them, and I'm sure they're great, and then they are.
I mean, in Shosan's case, like, his willingness to bring people on, like, he telegraphs it. Because, I mean, it always seems like he's like, okay, I'm going to use them for my scheme. And then you realize his scheme is just like, nah, I really want people to survive. But I think the prone one is more interesting. Because the prone one, when you first rescue the tree clan prone, which at this point there has been no distinction drawn between types of prone to you. Mm-hmm. You have killed an innumerable number of prone. They're going to tell their descendants about this horrible beast that slaughtered millions of their family. You are about to become like the boogeyman for prone children. And suddenly you're on this mission where you have to go get prone, and you're like, I don't want anything to do with them. Like, I'm getting them to kill them, right? And the idea that, well, no, that there is sort of a in their case, it's kind of a religious difference. It is somewhat racial in that some are purple. But generally speaking, it seems to be more when they talk about their belief system, like what they believe to be sacred. And when you bring in the Cavern Clan, there is tension there, and it doesn't abate right away, and it doesn't resolve cleanly. Ultimately, it only resolves because the Cavern Clan that you bring on board, which is a very small subset, is willing to help out them because they owe you a favor, not because they have any affinity for these people. And pride and racism and just a general hatred for the other causes these tree clan to turn down their offer to help and ends up costing them their lives. Like, that's the one time it resolves in a way where when you talk to the tree clan afterwards, they're like, or maybe we should let them help. And when you talk to the Cavern Clan, they sound like arrogant assholes afterwards. Like, man, we told them they're useless people. You should just get rid of them. Like, that one resolves in a way that feels kind of organic. And I think part of the reason it's hard for the game to sort of resolve these interplay questions is they don't necessarily know who you've got around at any given moment because of the non-linear nature of how the game built its world. Because I think you can actually skip finding the Orphei altogether. I know you can, or the ones that start with Z. I can't even figure out how to pronounce it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The ones that absorb Voltant.
Yes.
they're actually one of the least liked alien races in the game because there's so many quests around them just basically freaking people out. Yeah. Which I enjoy it quite a lot, but
I think there's a limit. I think what James brings up is important in terms of there's a limitation to what they probably were willing to do with the story in terms of, well, it's not that story driven. You haven't necessarily got certain characters in your party at a given point, like for all of these things. Obviously, the affinity quests are the ones that stipulate those. But then the broader normal quests, there's a lot of variables there. So it's just easier to have it like communicated in text and all that kind of stuff. I think it blunts its impact to go back to
totally.
The email, that it does blunt its impact. However, I'm glad that they did explore some of these themes, however sort of limited
superficially
they could. Yeah, it's limited, but I'm glad they did because it just at least does a few interesting things with these side quests that I just wasn't really expecting. Like I said, it goes obviously, in terms of gameplay, a lot of the time they're going to boil down to something fairly kind of standard. It might be go this place, fight these things, bring back these things, or whatever. Go from A to B and back to A, and all that kind of stuff. But the fact that they managed to dress them up a bit with the limited kind of resources they had, I think made those parts of the game more appealing. It did add some value. I just think there's a pretty definite cap on how much they could add. And I mean, you could argue maybe it's the kind of material that deserves merits a more full exploration. But I think they did a somewhat enjoyable job with what they had.
You do spend a surprising amount of time fighting humans, and usually it does come back to questions of xenophobia.
Also it often comes back to questions of, to come back to the point that John was making, capitalism and money.
Yeah,
because there's so many times when you're on a quest and then you get ambushed because some asshole blades are in it for the reward and they're waiting for you to complete the quest for them and then they're going to kill you, as if killing you was going to be possible in this game where you're a star.
Well, but, it's possible to you till they think your body wakes up, but by then, who cares? We have all the money.
The thing is, like, the whole humans being on the run after their planet has been destroyed, that it's a well-trodden theme in science fiction. And so this game, most of the time, feels like a collection of tropes. And it just feels like there could have been more imagination put into the way that it handles these tropes. And I'm just reminded, like, when I see, like, how it doesn't make sense that you'd reward these blades with money on in this planet where there's 50,000 souls. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of apparently Margaret Atwood, the science fiction author, invited science fiction authors to imagine alternatives to capitalism. It's just funny how this game doesn't even try.
Yeah, it doesn't even bother. Like,
even if it would make sense in the context, they're like, well, no, whatever, like, who cares? And the more you think about it, the more disturbing it is, because, it leads to these other blades that are assholes, that are apparently, there's no screening happening when someone becomes a blade, apparently. Like, any asshole can be one.
Well, there's a limit on how many people they've got to work with, so I guess...
Sure, but maybe don't give the laser weapons to the assholes. I don't know.
He's also got psychically controlled robot guns, okay?
Sure,
hey,
sure.
It's a fierce world we're on here, right, Guillaume?
Well, maybe if you're about to give a blade license to a woman named Murderess, like, take a step back.
It's a nickname, Guillaume.
That's a very
good
point.
It's not her birth name.
The Murderess thing, was so kind of confounded by this character. Like, okay, so this is someone you can recruit that, like, tries to kill you and all that. I ended up going through her affinity missions and stuff. And basically, like, she's an orphan from a wealthy family that's trying to rebuild the family fortune, the sort of dynasty on me.
Right.
I get that. That's why she's so driven by money, is that her family was rich, but they lost it all because they were killed by some guy who just happens to be on Mira as well.
Oh, what a coincidence.
what kills me is, I'm blanking on her name. The lieutenant.
Irina?
Yeah. Is when you first meet Murderess, it's with Irina.
Yeah.
Who, Irina has anger control problems. Like, just constant, never-ending anger control issues. to the point where there was a time where I thought, she's going to be the bad guy, isn't she? And Murderous tries to kill you both, hits on you, then offers you a job, and walks off.
And you take it.
And my first thought is, Irina at every point from now would have killed that bitch. Like, would have just got up there and just ripped her head from her shoulders, slammed it against a rock, and then possibly eaten part of it. Just to make a point. And then so after that quest, immediately I was hanging out with Gwyn, who is got puppy dog eyes for Irina.
Hopeless.
Which is like,
yep.
Have you met her, bro?
She's a terrible person.
Nuts. She's kind of a crazy person.
Yep.
You should not do this. But like, it's weird. Like, I did the affinity quests for all the non-DLC characters except for, I guess I did it for all of them. But I found the DLC ones in a weird way more enjoyable. Like, Bose or Bose's, how you pronounce
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I did was all of his,
just,
I think.
Just yeah. stupidity.
He's just like a monk, like, kind of like, you know, martial arts.
He's a monk who's super obsessed with Japan.
Yeah.
But he's not Japanese. Yeah. He's just super obsessed with
yeah,
Japan.
He was one of the guys, I had him in my party when I beat the game. I kind of rolled with him to the end.
He's ridiculous. But like,
yeah, he is absurd.
He's also the one that's pretty racist too, right?
I can't remember.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he is. At least at first. I haven't...
When you first meet him, he's like, you know, just leave this guy. Just leave... I think leave this
man on to die.
Yeah. Yeah, the Manon's there, and he's like, just let that Manon die.
Right.
And he's like, fine, we can save him.
If you say yes, leave it to die, does it let you do it, or does it just stop you? Do you get Chausson? You're like, we should really rescue this guy.
Well, there's a few times where selecting something in a quest will lead to drastically different results. Like, there's one where at the very beginning, you can spare these baby pigs or whatever. Whatever
the
they are.
The suits.
And if you do, and it's presented to you as the good option because they haven't done anything and, you know, they're not a threat, well, much later they'll have killed someone and you'll be blamed.
Yeah, and it's the same thing too with fixing the helicopter blade as well. You can choose red or blue. And one of them kills one of the people and one of them doesn't.
Yeah.
On the
yeah,
way
and when you get there, like, everybody's like, hey, we know you made the choice, but you did a good job.
Yep. Yeah.
It's like,
but you don't get
try.
As much money though. That's the thing. And so I went
at
back and I made it
try.
So that they were saved.
There you
so
go.
I killed them first. John. I think I chose red. I think red is the one that kills them. I think
red is the bad choice.
Yep.
Okay. So I withdraw what I said. Capitalism did save a
there
life
you go.
In that case.
Touche.
I like that their response is, well, we should bring arms manufacturers because that's the first thing we need. And then you realize, oh, they were right. They really did need to bring the arms manufacturers. It's like, good job.
Well, so you need competition, don't you? That's the
sure,
thing.
Good
the market
they,
needs to
he
operate.
Actually says that, though. That's the part.
I'm disappointed with the lack of recognition of the miracle of modern capitalism here. You know,
it's
just...
true. Modern capitalism defeated
the gangrene.
Let's make
Mira great again, Greg.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's the one thing I will say is that I, as I said when we talked about this, you know, some months ago, I really like the economy in the game though. So it's one of my favorite things about the game is the way that your exploration of the planet changes, you know, that your kind of participation in the economy, you know, of the biggest thing being the Meranium. You know, and how you can trade that for things, you know, improving the arms dealers and all that kind of stuff. So just, you know, that however much sense it makes that they would have such a kind of perfect replication of the market economy with such a few number of people on this crazy other world, I think it served the game well, because that was one of my favorite things about it. Just the feeling that, you know, me pushing out into the world, putting the nodes in, all that stuff, doing the thing that for me the game was the most about, you know, finding the sightseeing spots and then bringing in more money and all that kind of stuff, making the mining more efficient and chaining together the nodes because I'd found them from a wrecked car or whatever, like you said, you know, but that was just from exploration, you know, and that was the biggest thing for me is that, you know, watching how much, you know, you've got, rather than just getting money from battles, you get this revenue stream, you know, that you're building and building. And as that goes, you know, as you build that up, you know, the kind of gear you're able to buy is so much better, and then you can push further out into the world, and then your revenue grows greater, and so it goes on this virtuous circle. I just thought that I've never seen the economy of a world so integrated into a world before.
Yeah.
In a video game.
I mean, it, quite literally.
Into
actually.
An RPG of this type. So that actually was really cool, whether or not it sits all that comfortably into the narrative.
Yeah, that's not how I perceived it, though. To me, it just felt like way too many meters going up with time, kind of like in a free-to-play game, you know, kind of just like a hook to keep you playing and
watch those meters go up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like so many systems, you know, like you not only have to pay for weapons from the arms manufacturers, but you have to help them upgrade. And you know, you've got two different, like you've got the what's it called, the resource Miranium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have to keep getting and spending, otherwise it's going to be lost because you've got a finite amount to store it.
Yeah, the storage cap is annoying as hell.
Yeah, no, but that is a big deal. I mean, that is one of the biggest things about that I kind of grew to kind of attach a much greater priority on as I went on. It's like, okay, you know, actually, you know, getting these different probes and them chaining them together in the proper ways could
yep.
vastly increase how much you're going to be able to store, and therefore
right.
how much you're going to be able to upgrade things more quickly and all that. And again, just achieving that kind of mastery over the system. Again, I mean, they could be, should be, probably more transparent, but for my part, I didn't even sort of, I, again, as I've said before, I tended to just sort of bumble my way through things. I almost didn't want to explain to me that explicit. I kind of liked finding things out for myself, even if it did lead to some inefficient gameplay and maybe some amount of hours being spent that you know, probably shouldn't have been spent. But that's the kind of thing I'm a lot more tolerant of in an off TV environment than if I'm setting aside time to sit in front of the TV. You know, it's more scarce for me, and so, you know, that's just one of the great things about, you know, being able to do it off TV plays. It allowed me to get a lot more into those facets of the game, whereas, you know, say for instance, similar facets, although they're not there to the same extent in the Wii game, I didn't get anywhere near down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, this game burned down my gamepad something fierce. What I would do is I would play it using the gamepad all the time, because you're always, I really did like how they allowed you to fast travel pretty much anywhere once you got the means to do so. Lay down all the nodes and everything. But yeah, I mean, I was constantly referring, like, using the gamepad, doing the mining stuff, all that kind of stuff. And pretty much what I would do is I would burn down, like, my gamepad would start to die, put it back on its cradle to charge it, switch over to the Wii U Pro controller. And then once it got charged, I would go back to the gamepad. And it's like, I would just sit there in these, like, marathons, just going
back
and forth.
You really miss the touchscreen when you don't have it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I had to find a place where I could sit while it was plugged in.
Yep.
Because
same here.
It was brutal whenever you'd start to realize, oh, I'm going to lose it. I'm going to lose the touchscreen. I need it charged right now.
Mm-hmm.
No, I had a USB charger cable for my gamepad, so it means I'm not anchored to one spot so much with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of places where I can plug a USB charger into something, and that proved very valuable when playing Xenoblade.
It does seem like that game murders the thing fast for me because I'm interacting with it a lot, but this game created some, moving away from the plot. We've talked it to death. This game created some marathons. Like,
oh yeah,
I had a 2 week vacation. And
I know the time of year that it was out. I mean,
I dropped 70 hours in those 2 weeks.
Well, I did the math, and from the day that I got this, because I didn't start playing it the day it launched. I was out of town, and I came back, and so I think I mapped it out, and I played it for 27 days straight, and I put 118 hours into it. So I played about 4.5 hours a day on average. But there were some days there where I would get up in the morning and I would play it all the way through to like 2
oh,
in the
yeah.
morning.
Oh, yeah.
Like the whole day.
It's that feedback loop. It's that same thing that you talk about with like Monster Hunter, because it does have some Monster Hunter-ness in it.
Yeah, but also there's always something else to do. Like if you don't feel like doing like getting involved in a quest line, just go and lay down some nodes, or just explore somewhere, or go see what's over there. See what's over there. There's always like you rarely get to the point where you're just the thought of doing something becomes a chore. It's like, I'll just do something that's not a chore, but offers me a little reward. Much like a free-to-play game, like we referred to earlier.
Or an MMO.
Yeah. That kind of quick hit I'll log in, do something quickly and log off kind of deal.
I got really mad at myself when you find the life hold. Let me explain. So you can't map the whole world before the end of the game. There's some story locks that prevent you from getting to a couple of the probes. But I had mapped pretty much everything that I could get to. And I had done really stupid, risky things, like jumped out of my skull to try to land on a probe that was covered in nasty enemies.
I actually have a question. How do you get the level 5 engineering?
Level 5 engineering?
All the level 5s of those cryptic quests. I wish they'd been a bit more upfront about it, because I would have got the level 5 sooner.
Yeah, because I never opened any of them.
They kind of things where they tell you, like, okay.
They're riddles.
Yeah, these little cryptic messages about, okay, so, you know, if you got the, like, something that'll give away the location of something, so it's telling you to get two of this from this area, but not in so many words.
In the land of white, find a thing that glows, you know.
Yeah, silver, and, you know, you got to find this thing. And then you do all that quest line, and then you'll get access to level 5, you know, bio or mechanical or archaeological, you know, and that, of course, is needed to do all the probes.
Yep.
Right. Basically, you find a dude in town who created this system, and he's like, I've got level 5, but I'm only going to get the people who really deserve it.
Yeah, correct.
Right. But unfortunately, the game does that thing where one of the three clues usually for any given level 5 skill is going to be find this many of this thing, and most of the time they're going to be rare.
Rare drops, so you don't know. Knew what it was, you might be able to use the reward tickets to go and buy it.
I'm really talking about, because even if you look it up and you buy, you get those with the tickets. I'm talking about like the kind of crystal things that you find in the overworld.
Oh, the ones that are just freestanding in the world map.
You can't cheat get them by cheating. So it's just like you have to keep respawning in a certain spot and move over to the crystals and get them and hope that you're going to get what you need.
Yeah, there's one on top of the mountain in Silvalum. Yep. And I just respawned to that spot 25 times in the scale and just blasted around it.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
No, it's terrible. No. But
I think that whole thing, I think that was a mistake in terms of locking, because I said, having
But it
level
was a mistake in Xenoblade Chronicles.
Well, like, you can make the same mistake twice.
I think, but I mean, more specifically, just the fact that for me, like, you know, that was kind of the core metric of progress in the game is those probes. And then you've got a certain amount of them are locked behind these cryptic quests. Everything, you know, is locked by different things in various ways, but that felt a bit too
I'm saying, like,
I mean, it's all artificial, but that felt,
that was
Xenoblade Chronicles had the same problem, where if you were trying to rebuild Colony 6, there was a specific point where you wouldn't be able to upgrade a certain thing more unless you got these drops, and they were extremely rare, and that's where I stopped. You know?
I never even got going on the Colony 6 stuff, like I said, because the way I played that game was totally different because of the lack of off-TV play.
Right. So I just, I'm a little bit frustrated at the fact that, you know, this monolith didn't really even try to fix
they
these problems.
They kind of doubled down on it. Some extent,
yeah, they did.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff where I'm just like, I'm not even messing with this. I'm going to an FAQ. I'm just not even going to bother.
And
like, including stuff like the sightseeing stuff, where, like, you have no idea where, like, there's nothing to indicate where that stuff is on the map.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, a lot of times I just stumble into them.
Yep.
No, I like stumbling. I like stumbling into them, and I like searching for them on occasion. You know, they'd say, "Well, it's here somewhere. There's only so many places it can be."
There's a really cool one in Silvalum that it's just a rift, and I fell into it. I got in a fight and just fell in. And you just fall for a long ass time. And then at the bottom, like, you found a sightseeing. I'm like, this isn't sightseeing. This is death.
Yeah.
And then there's a big nasty monster. And I'm like, oh, go, get out. Everybody.
No, some of the hardest to find sightseeing spot have a nightmare creature in them.
Run!
There's a reason why no one's discovered this before. they might have done, but they wouldn't have lived to tell about it.
Oh, it was bad. Yeah. But, like, yeah, I agree. The level 5 quests are awful, and I ended up looking up all of them at some point. Like, I just couldn't deal with them, and they weren't fun. But the where I was going before we got way off target was I was mad about the life hold and not mad about the game. I think dropping it in the ocean was a smart decision because it sort of explains why we didn't find it. I was mad because at that point I realized I did not do a good job exploring this world because I bet the life hold was... Do you think the life hold was there?
Well, I'm not going to restart a save.
Well,
to
I know.
Find out,
but
I don't think so because I will say that that
there is a piece of the life hold that is hanging out the entire game that it seems to be completely on its own, and then it's a quest.
Yeah,
I'm curious if the whole life hold is ever there.
I doubt it, just because I don't think you could get to it. You wouldn't be able to get to it. I think it would turn your back.
No, I said there are for as open as it is, there are little force fields.
Oh,
even
you think
in
it would invisible
caves.
Wall you?
I think it
so
would.
So I think yeah, if it's going to do that for like some fairly minor quest lines in caves, I would assume
it
could do that.
Yeah, because I did actually go out there. I didn't go all the way out there, but there's an island out there with like a level 92 monster, and it's one of those things you can see it from the shoreline. And I was just like, wait a minute. That's one of the things I really liked was the fact that like you'll see something out on the water and you're like, is that something? And you just keep
going.
That's
why I was mad. I felt like I didn't explore the world well enough.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I went out there. That's pretty far out there. I would think that I probably would have seen the life hold if it. I don't know. Maybe I wasn't.
Were you
far
in the right
enough.
Area?
Yeah, I was in the right area, but I wasn't. Okay. I wasn't far north enough for it. But the life hold's pretty big.
Yeah, you see when. To me, that is the coolest moment of the game.
Yeah.
When it basically says, go to the life hold, and you are flying to it, because I didn't just... You can't warp there.
Yep.
And you are flying there, and if you've got skeletons on everybody, they're flying behind you, and you just see this thing coming up out of nowhere. Like, it doesn't just pop in. As the game does a very good job of slowly revealing horizon and adding detail. Mm-hmm. And then you see there's fighting going on around it, and then it kicks into that video, and that's like the first time in the game you feel like, oh shit, we're gonna win this thing.
Yeah.
Like this is the first time where we're fucking winning. Mm-hmm. And that's the coolest moment in the game probably, because for a very brief second, like, it all flips, because the entire game is just like, we have got to just not die.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like, oh, we are about to kick some ass right now. Mm-hmm. You are about to get housed. Mm-hmm. And that's such an awesome reveal, and it's just like, why can't more of the game have more reveals like that in it?
Yeah, it was really, really cool.
That and the big giant robot. Mm-hmm. Like, that's probably the most satisfying ending to the game, to a boss encounter, the big, huge one. Mm-hmm. It's in Civilum, right? Where you fight
the weird little girl alien hijacks or whatever with a giant companion.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a cool feeling. Like, when that thing goes down and when you come back later and there's just wreckage everywhere.
Yeah,
and
it's
like,
a feature of the environment. Like, that's what case of the world actually changes, you know, due to something in the story.
I wrecked this thing. It's like, yeah, I did this. I did this. Elmo, you didn't do this. I did this. Like, there is a certain sense of just satisfaction with a lot of the game's missions that I really enjoy.
Yep.
We do have a question that kind of ties to that, though. We haven't really talked about the different groups you can have, and I've seen it explained what the difference is. It's kind of meh. But Jason wrote, hey guys, rather than gush over these games, I'll leave you and ask a few questions. One, in a sequel, would you like division-specific missions? In this game, you do kind of get a taste for every type of blade. But past that, which division you choose is largely irrelevant.
That's not the case at all.
It's not the case insofar as the rewards you get from the online mode. But it is with respect to, like, the quests you can do.
True.
But no, you can do any quest as anyone.
Right, that's what he's saying.
Right.
Yeah, he said he chose a mediator. A lot of missions took place in the city. Solving crimes to the game would or rather, he's suggesting, like, if you picked a mediator, would you get to continue to play that, that version of Deadly Premonition in space that this game is when you're inside town? Like, get to, yeah, I gotta go deeper.
Mediator Pikachu, is that what we're talking about?
Oh, yeah. I think that would
voiced
be cool
by Danny DeVito, finally.
If you wanted to make the game replayable, like, be what division you choose makes impact on the kind of quest you can pick up.
Yeah.
Because the mediator missions were just never ending nonsense.
Yep.
I mean, including, we talked about it, the pizza guy who deployed that pizza is putting bombs in his pizza. Like, and what do they call it? The extra spice pizza or something like that? Some idiotic thing like that. Like, he's a murderer because Manon ordered too much pizza. That is his reason to kill.
Oh, you've just reminded me of the whole politics side quest now.
trying to rig
an election or whatever because the Manon have just gone off the deep end and are going to make everything about pizza.
Right, they're going to replace all currency with pizza. And the Orphei are like, hey, this is probably a really bad idea. You should probably do something about this. And you as a police officer essentially rig an election with poison. Like you straight up involve putting drugs in a candidate's food, essentially. It's fucking insane. But then you have the quests, the quests that are tied more to collectors and the team that Yelv's in, the Reclaimers, that's it. Like, the Reclaimer quests usually get really dark. Like, it's usually like, hey, there's a piece of the life hold here. Oh, also, there's dead. Bad things happened. This is like, oh, okay, the Reclaimers aren't Reclaimers. You think, oh, they just go out and find shit. No, things are bad out that way. I would like to see more Division-specific stuff, but I mean, they do kind of hand-wave and say, like, well, the Division you're in doesn't really matter that much. Because you're still on Squad Elma, regardless. Which, you get the feeling that she operates beyond Divisions. Which, again, in the end, makes sense from a plot standpoint. It would be cool, I think, to have the Division you're in make quest differences, but you can also
have a more substantively different experience based on that.
Maybe Animal Crossing set in Mirror, where you can take different jobs. Done. Oh no, Tomodachi Life. The 2 million seller Tomodachi Life. Tomodachi Mira. For the quest that, or the team that you end up on determines what crazy antics your Tomodachi get into. And then the other question, why can't I have a Manon squad mate? They made 4 DLC characters and none of them were a little blue dog alien that says, man, I could use a slice or two after the battle. Completely unforgivable. the aliens. I thought they were actually, you know, making aliens is such a rote thing in science fiction. And we talked about how this game sort of, you know, kind of iterates over existing tropes. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought they did a good job with the alien design.
They were okay, yeah.
You had Thundercat, Klingons, and Dwarf Gungans.
Right. Yeah.
It wasn't outstanding, but I thought it was passable.
What's their name? The ones with the who breathe through that thing.
The Voltan.
The
Zobigans.
Zobigans?
Or however you pronounce it.
They seem to be straight out of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Totally. They totally are. Yeah. And like I said, most of the quests involve them scaring people. Like, yeah. Not intentionally, just being spooky because they wear a suit and like trash. But even they had a really dark quest line at one point where...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They basically had a religious schism take place, and you're like, all right, I'm going to fix this. And ultimately, it just ends up, no, you didn't fix it. And also, like, doesn't one of them end up holding... The schismatic has, like, evidence that all of their religion is a lie?
Yes, I remember this. So, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, I don't know how much this stuff, like, really earnestly hits home, but at least it's interesting.
Yeah,
you know, like, it's
flavor text.
I'm glad they went out there, you know, with some of these themes to kind of spice up those parts of the game, because they probably did need it a bit.
Yeah, I think that 84 did the localization for this game, and I think that they deserve a lot of credit for doing a lot with so little, because even though, well, so little, wow, that came out, I'm dismissive, no, like the game, you know, has a lot of interesting themes, maybe doesn't delve into it as much as I'd like, but anyway, they did a good job, I think, giving the flavor text flavor. You know, they did a good job giving personality to all these different aliens and these squad mates and everything. And just, you know, my favorite line in the game is during the murder most foul quest line. Because at the end, you find out that the person who's been poisoning these Manons is the pizza parlor owner. And
Army Pizza. Point,
Army Pizza. Mm-hmm.
And, Army Pizza.
I was just mashing, you know, kind of bored in a bored fashion, mashing through the A button to get through the dialogue. And at some point he says, like, oh, like, they killed my wife and I'll teach you why they called me Hellfire Margarita in the army. And I just lost it, you know, and I was so sad that I meshed through that and couldn't, like, get the screen capture and put that in Miiverse. But that was just, like, awesome line, and that happens more frequently than you'd think in this game. Well, you know, like for a game with this amount of text that they had to translate in pretty quickly and probably pretty cheaply, I assume. There's a lot of funny lines and funny stuff.
Yeah, and the one that I thought was really interesting was, you know, how, like, you when you walk by characters, you kind of overhear what they're saying to each other.
Yeah, you don't have to actually walk up to them and press A to, like, talk to them to hear something. You get this kind of passerby overhearing kind of thing, but with text.
Yeah, so the interesting one was with Lara Nara, which is a male character. They don't come out and say that he's gay when you first kind of talk to him or whatever, or even, like, talk really about that.
I mean,
but he wears makeup. You know, kind of hits on you, on your male character.
Very stereotypical.
Yeah, very stereotypical. And what was funny about that is that, you know, at first I was like, ah, whatever. You know, there's so many JRPGs with this kind of character. It's like, cause kind of comedy relief, kind of corny.
Japanese depiction of
exactly, of right? But what I thought was interesting was, you know, I'm just in the middle of, you know, going somewhere for some mission or some quest or something. And I overhear, two random NPCs, a woman talking to a guy, and she says, "Hey, Lara Nara thinks you're cute. Maybe you should go talk to him." And I was like, wait a minute, that just caught me off guard, because I'm like, wait a minute, this is kind of like just kind of background text alluding to this character's, you know, the fact that this character is gay. That just really stood out to me. Like, it wasn't like, not like it was a big deal, but I just thought that it was kind of like, it just seemed something like they went kind of like the extra mile to kind of put that in there for no other reason, just to kind of include it in there. Like, hey, yeah, whatever. It's not a big deal. It's just, hey, two people talking, that guy's gay. You should go talk to him, kind of thing. And I'd never really heard that in a game before. Like you know, like, cause usually games are like, hey, we have something gay over here. Look at us. You know, we're not stereotypical. We like gay people, right? But this was just like very subtle. And I thought that was pretty cool. I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive that they would even, like, kind of like put that in there, just throw it in there.
He is a background character.
Yeah.
But you encounter him a lot in the game. And more so than a lot of the background characters. He is a big player in one of the quest lines for one of the alien races.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting how these background characters, even characters, you know, the Army Pizza guy, you deal with him a lot in the game. A lot of these characters you see a bunch of times and you get to know their personality, even if they're not party characters, even if they're not quest characters. They're just around and you encounter them, which I think is interesting. Like, they don't exist singularly for the purpose of this one quest. Mm-hmm. They exist in the world and there are quests written around them, which I think is nice. Because a lot of games, if you think to like a GTA game where you get quests, that character who gives you the quest, if it's not a main story character, exists singularly for the moment of that quest.
Yep.
His literal reason to exist is to give you, is to tell you, man, you need to fly this RC airplane. Like, after that, he vanishes into the void like Bigfoot after that and no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this game, all of these characters, for the most part, they're in the world. They're on that big character map where they map out everybody's interaction. They exist. They have friends. They have family. They have peers. And, like, when you can encounter them later in the game and they may be reflecting upon whatever you help them with.
Yeah.
Like, that's that map where you can see every character and every interaction is unreal.
Yeah.
It was in Xenoblade Chronicles, but it just seems even more chaotic in this game.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and because the UI actually got worse.
No, but I mean, the other thing is they accumulate in this game, you know, in such an interesting way with all the different races and all that kind of stuff. You know, the whole place changes a hell of a lot as it goes on.
Right.
One of my favorite little moments, I think, is when I first got the flight module with the Skell. It's kind of an obvious thing. It's just that I'll go on top of the tower in the heart of a new LA. Like, why wouldn't you do that?
Absolutely.
Know? And then isn't there one of those Thundercat Klingon girls up there? Like, it's like, I've got weird ears. I'm ashamed.
She's
embarrassed.
She's like
by
right
her
on
ears.
Top of the tower.
Yeah.
And she's trying to cut her ears off. It's like, what?
And the answer is basically something like, wear a hat. Like, that's basically the end of the conversation.
Yep.
Like, oh, okay. It's like, you knew they were going to put something up there because they know that you're going to want to just see what's on top of that tower when you can finally get the opportunity to
do it. I just went up there to see the view because I was awestruck when I landed on the Manon ship and realized, oh, like, the Manon ship doesn't exist in its own world. It's part of the same game world. Like,
yeah, you kind of think of it as this segmented thing, but then once you get the scale in the air, it is just there, you know, with alongside everything else.
But then I was like, well, let's see the view from up here. And then there's just a person up there. And I'm like, what are you doing up here? And then we had that conversation. I'm like, yeah, I wish I hadn't flown up here. This dumb shit right here, I can't deal with. There's one of those floating rock islands, out on Primordia, and when you fly up there, you encounter somebody, and it's completely just weird and like, why are you here? What's going on? How do you even have a flight pack? These things just got invented, but it's just cool that stuff gets stuffed everywhere. To use the same word for two different meanings.
But isn't it kind of standard though in open world games to put little Easter eggs or stuff like that
it usually, to reward players? It usually just feels like Easter eggs. It's like to take it to Crackdown, a game that really was about you need to find a way to get on top of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost always just upgrade orbs. In this game, it's never anything like that. It's usually...
It's much less important.
I disagree. I disagree.
Sometimes it's sightseeing spots, which, you know, like I said, can be important for, you know, getting more money out and sort of enjoying.
But it might end up being like a quest. Like,
but
it
could be a quest, and sometimes it might be something really trivial. I mean, it doesn't feel like there's a particularly kind of hard
and
fast
just collect
kind of
thing.
Yeah, it's not kind of a hard and fast delineation of like, well, the harder it is to get somewhere, the better the reward is, or is this kind of reward, that kind of reward. It feels pretty sort of organically randomized or something. But I get the one thing I would say is I like the world design in general. You know, aesthetically, I think it's good. I think, you know, in terms of how it ties into the mobility of the first of all, you know, yourself, and then the scale without the flight module, and then with the flight module, you know, I think all of that feels pretty good. I just kind of wish they'd done a bit more with caves, you know, I mean, there are some sort of late game caves where you might only be able to get in there, you reach them, you know, with a scale, but then you're going to have to get out and on foot and explore it a bit more, right. Just to kind of preserve a more kind of separate usefulness and all that for your standard character outside of the mech, but still they don't feel. I feel like that was an opportunity to maybe have some areas that were a bit more explicitly and carefully designed, you know, like real level design rather than world design, if you know what I mean. That would have been cool. And there's some of that. There's a little bit of that, you know, and you can find some cool stuff, or you'll push forward through there and fight a bunch of monsters and level up a number of things, and then you might find a particular, you know, kind of special creature or a treasure or this, that, and the other, or a number of treasures in some cases. But I felt like, you know, that was somewhere there, perhaps, you know, if it wasn't the case that they were just getting all these fundamentals down, as James talked about earlier, that's an area where you could really push forward and give, you know, give it a bit of a different flavor from the bits where you're just out in the sprawling world and, you know, looking at the big vistas and everything's kind of open and all that kind of stuff, and get back to kind of more like dungeony kind of RPG design in those little bits.
Right. Yeah, but one thing that I encountered, a problem that I encountered at a lot of caves, is that the enemies seem to respawn a little bit too quickly.
Oh,
I don't
right.
know if anyone else has had that problem, but
yes.
sometimes, like, when I was just at the right level, you know, like, where I wasn't really too over-leveled to go through a cave, sometimes, you know, some enemies are patrolling, like, they're on a certain path, and
yeah.
they keep going on the path, and so, okay, like, you look at their pattern, okay, I'm going to dispatch them, and then I'm going to go to the end of the cave where there's all these insects, and I'm going to dispatch them all, and then I'm going to be able to get to that treasure. And I would try to execute that plan, and through no fault of my own, at some point, well, okay, it took me perhaps a little bit too long to dispatch these insects, and now that patrolling creature has come back to life and is attacking me, and you know, it's just making
yeah,
this fight drag on.
Yeah, I think that's more of a problem
on.
In the caves than because, like, you know, certain areas where I was going into like prone strongholds early on,
yeah.
you know, like I would be able to kind of lure them away, kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Then lure another few way, you know, and make a lot more headway than if I just, yeah, you know, I wasn't nearly strong enough to just go in there and, you know, say hello to my little friend. Just
yeah.
So you could kind of do that, you know, sort of strategically kind of pick people off and all that. But, whereas in the caves, yeah, I don't really remember ever being able to kind of do that. Again, that's just, I kind of like that. And then it mostly disappeared from the game because you get the scale and, you know, any time you're out in the open, pretty much, unless you're going to bail for reasons of preserving it or whatever, you know, you're just going to be able, you're just going to want to use that. And you mostly, unless it's, you know, really big creatures or something, you can pretty much kill stuff indiscriminately.
Yeah, the one that jumps out to me about the caves where I decided I hate caves in this game, and I'm not actually a big fan of them, is the Celica quest, where you have to go rescue Celica from a cave.
Yeah.
And that cave is a nightmare. And they're like, oh, these cool skills you have now? Yeah, fuck you, you can't take them in. Now,
yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that was an opportunity. I think there was an opportunity to do something kind of interesting and do something that keeps, you know, that. But yeah, there's a lot of character building in this game that isn't about the skill, you know.
Right.
And it kind of feels like, you know, it'd be nice to have a strand of the game that keeps that relevant.
Sure, I just found that particular
I agree with you. No, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I feel like, you know, if we were talking about a sequel or whatever, you know, something that continues in this bloodline or whatever, you know, like that's something I think they could improve on quite a lot.
So, I've got one more thing I want to touch on, and then I'll let each of us kind of wrap it up with one thing they want to talk about: the overdrive system in your scale. Oh, not your scale. Sorry, in your mimeosome. I just found out relatively, like, pretty much after I finished the game, that you could cheese that thing to hell and back by design and essentially turn into an unstoppable killing machine.
Yeah, you can chain it so that you have pretty much unlimited overdrive.
Unlimited everything, yeah.
Yeah.
And overdrive is super powerful, and it's all about how you build your character. And that feels like such a freaking Western RPG thing of, like, if you build your character this specific stat way with these specific skills, like, you become an unstoppable god. And I didn't expect that at all. Like,
yeah.
I had no expectation that was going to be in this game. And
but, I mean, JRPGs have long been like that, though. Like, Knights of the Round says hello, and 2X Cut from, like, you know, Final Fantasy VII.
That's true. You know, that the mixing those two together is,
yep.
is just
it's a joke. That's how you take out the hardest bosses.
It's like, oh, you just killed the final boss in one move.
I mean,
move.
That's
great.
I mean, it's like you basically kick off your attacks and walk away for 10 minutes and make a sandwich.
But like, overdrive was so cool when you fired it up. Like, it was such a cool thing. Like, oh man,
but
I am gonna have
to. They don't explain it at all.
No!
At all.
I didn't realize you could,
like,
chain it.
Like, what the hell is the whole cockpit thing? Like, I was like, what?
Oh,
like,
that's the zoom mode of you're in your scale. That's also awesome.
Yeah, but they don't explain, like, that either. Like,
yeah.
They don't explain anything.
Especially when you're dealing with something that's got a huge cooldown.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The hex particle, you know, you get a freebie.
Oh, the hex particle?
Yep, the hex particle. God
Say
bless.
Say hello to my giant friend.
Yep, that thing is just, that's a one-shot machine. I love it.
I told you that, that Gwyn had that on him during the final boss battle because I forgot to take it off. I meant to take it off of him.
Yep.
And so there's one where there's, like, a bunch of small enemies you have to fight. And all of a sudden, just shit just rips through the battle. Like, this beam just comes flying through it, and they're all dead. I'm like, what the fuck happened?
Mm-hmm.
And I turned around, and Gwyn's gotten back in his skell, and he's just standing there. I'm like, you son of a bitch.
The thing is, they do disable it for the very final boss, though.
Yeah, they do disable it.
But the thing is, they don't even tell you that, though. All of a sudden, you're like, what the hell? I can't use my Hexparticon anymore. And it actually took me a couple of shots at the final boss to realize that they take away all of your fuel for it.
Yeah.
I was like, that's when Lau turns into the second malformation of William Birkin from Resident Evil 2.
Yes! There is something, if you ever want to have an adventure, put a Hex Particle on one of your party's skulls, and then just like occasionally watch them decide that that one insect that just went hostile for no reason needs to have the entire power of a nuclear bomb shot directly at them.
Oh yeah, it's awesome.
And you'll see it like shoot across the stage and just kill like 40 things. You're like, oh, I'm glad we're out.
Area of effect part of that is extremely satisfying.
Yeah, very handy for grinding too.
I beat one of the really, really, really nasty tyrants. There's that ape one outside of town.
Mm-hmm.
That's really high level. I just stacked on a bunch of like critical boosts on the scale, like boost my critical odds, and just loaded it with that, and then fired the Hex Particle at it. It just critical and just did an obscene number. Like,
yep.
I don't think it displayed right. The number was so big. And then it just died in one shot. I'm like, I want to go kill all of the bad things now.
Yep.
Because
it's very
again,
important you don't disturb the fauna.
That's right. Because we're going to live in harmony with this fauna after I've vaporized them.
And the thing is too, you can actually, I think, upgrade it at least two more times.
Yes.
Like, it's just, the thing would be ungodly powerful if you upgraded it all the way.
Oh, it's so dumb. All right, that was what I want to talk about. Anybody else have something they want to touch on?
When you brought up the big ape thing, like it just
love for the big ape. Yeah.
No, but I mean, that one of the disappointments with the game actually is with the scales. Like when I got mine the first time, it almost immediately got destroyed, and I was like, "What the hell?" Right? But even once, like I upgraded to the something better than the one that they give you. And got more powerful weapons and armor on it. It was still disappointing, and I think a major part of that is because you're fighting bigger enemies, but a lot of those are just the same, like relative to your scale, as smaller versions of those enemies were relative to your squad mates.
Right.
Like the apes. I mean, you had already
Simius and Great Simius or whatever.
Yeah, like, you had already fought so many apes that were bigger than your party. And okay, so you embark on a skull, and then basically the same freaking character model that you're fighting, but it's bigger, you know?
Yeah, like that has a lot more effect when you're still on foot and you encounter like the giant Simius, and it's just this hulking thing. You think, I don't want any. Oh, and it's hostile too. Good. And then suddenly, like, Lin's been thrown against a rock and is dead. And you're like, well,
yeah,
we're not coming back for her. Let's just keep running.
That's certainly one of the problems, is that they don't really. It's so easy to pull aggro from enemies that can one shot you by accident, when really you're not even trying to pull aggro off of them. You're just trying to get through to some place else.
Yeah, and it's not such a problem when you don't have your skill, but once you do, it becomes a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Yep.
Also, the camera on the skill can be kind of annoying. It just seems it's always too close behind the skull. You need to zoom it out.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. You need to zoom it out, absolutely. Yep.
But there is something about building your skill in such a way that you
I think that's what I didn't quite appreciate at first. And, you know, like I said, it's kind of a big part about it in the post game that I haven't really, you know, kind of where I dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
Is like how much you can craft a skill that is so much more powerful.
Oh, yeah, the Mass Demon 90 is a nightmare. That's
a lot of that's I think what it's trying to kind of drive you towards is the satisfaction of creating the Death Star, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what they want you to get into that.
I have done an online fight against, I want to say it was against the bosses from the Xenoblade Chronicles, the original.
Telethia.
Yeah. I watched somebody do a Telethia fight where they just used the chained up overdrive mode and just killed Telethia basically on every single move. Like, they would just kill it. Because the thing is, in that online thing, it just respawns it until you die. So, like, your award is based on how many of them you killed. But I went in there with somebody a rando with a skell, and he was just blasting it. Like, he just parked. And basically, my only job was keep the thing busy.
Yeah.
And he would just unload, and every time he unloaded, the thing died. Like, all I was doing was, like, softening it up very, very slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine that the skells that people must have now, after a couple of months of just sitting there, like, you know, once they've beaten the game.
There is a skell that you can unlock, the hardest skell to get to, that is apparently a world ender.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was cool that some of the skells that you encounter and you fight against in the game can be unlocked as skell, you know.
Yeah.
Skell,
including that the one that gets stolen.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Anybody else have anything they want to talk about before we wrap up?
This is not me trying to pull like a gotcha on you, James, but I just remember when you said that you really found it fun when exploring the game. Like, okay, so you're jumping around, climbing up these mountains, and then you get your skell, and all of a sudden, like, it's a whole new world opens up to you, and you can jump so much higher and climb these different surfaces that you couldn't before, and it's just so much fun. And then, you know, of course, the ultimate upgrade is the flying gear. But I just find it funny that in this game, like, it's you feel it so, you know, so much, like, oh, this upgrade in mobility, when these moments are like you get like 12 of them in 3 hours in a Metroid game.
Yeah, but a Metroid game's world sucks by comparison. So
I think very disagree. Very different school of design.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know, but my point is more like two mobility upgrades for like a 100-hour game seems a little bit thin.
Yeah.
But it certainly marks them out as being very major, you know.
Right.
It has a sort of weight to it that you know, that amount of experience, that amount of time leading up to those moments. So John's kind of talked about, you know, the way they kind of build up the scales, you're giving you something to look forward to and all that, you know. I mean, I think in terms of like from a mechanical point of view, yeah, it's not all that sophisticated or dynamic. But in terms of, you know, sort of an experiential one, I think it gives it this weight of that really lends to that sensation of freedom that James is talking about.
Well, and you've seen there is more to see in a single continent of one of these games than there is in any Metroid game. And you have seen four continents worth or so. And because I didn't go to Calderos until after I already could already fly. Like,
yeah.
I just
Calderos like, wasn't really that impressive to me anyways.
I went there once on foot and said, oh, this is a disaster.
It's Mordor. There's not that much sort of, it's not as pretty or as interesting as the others visually.
The only part about Calderos that's interesting is that they didn't build all this stuff. They just kind of found it. And like, well,
they just set up shop there.
Who the hell built this then? But
it's that weird Colosseum that you fight Lao in and all, you know.
Luxar's Villa, when you realize he just moved in, but they still renamed it like Luxar's Villa. You're like, this asshole. But the idea that you know, I've seen so much of Primordia by the time I got a skell that getting it. Like, I knew the places I couldn't get to, or I knew the places I was afraid to go.
Yeah, there's like such a pent up demand to go to all these places. Like, I just went crazy and got every single node I could get anywhere.
Right. And
because you're looking at those parts of the map and it's like, oh yeah, that's a node I can't get to yet. That's a node I can't get to yet. And then once you know you have the tools, it's like, right, I've got to go to all those ones.
Yep.
Gobble them up, you know.
And there isn't anything stopping you either, which is what I thought was really, really cool. Like, yeah, if you can, I mean, you can go to the, you know, practically to the end game, just start swimming.
Yeah, at the very first thing you can do is walk out the back, once you get control, is walk out of New LA, go out to the back, swim out the back area, and swim around, and eventually you will reach Calderos.
Yeah.
And the game planned for that by putting a bunch of level 4 enemies right on the beach of Calderos.
Yep.
Like, if you want to bypass the entire game world and go straight to the final boss or the final area, knock yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? Like, once you leave the beaches, it's going to get very real for you very fast.
Yeah.
And there are going to be enemies there that eat you alive quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't go there until I'd already, like, I saw Calderos from Silverlum, and that was how I got there. I walked over the land bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And like that, to me, all those transition moments where you cross into a new continent for the first time, and it's just like, oh. Like, the first one you do into Noctilum, it's not very impressive because you do it in a cave.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, like, in my head, I'm thinking, oh, they're just hiding the fact it's loading a new game world.
Yeah, the thing,
and
though, reality, for me, though, I went in there at night, which was really impressive. Like, that was the first time I saw Noctilum. I was like, what? This is crazy.
But when you go to Oblivia, it's not a cave. It's like you go over a pass or something.
Yep.
And you essentially come down the other side of the mountain, and you go, okay, I'm here now. A Silvalum you have to swim to. And to me, that transition is one of the coolest parts of the game. Like, you land there, the music's going. This continent looks very different from everything else. Like, Noctilum, Silvalum, and Primordia all felt like different phases of kind of the same world. But you get to Silvalum, it feels very alien. Like, it doesn't feel earthish anymore at all. And that's really fun. Like, there's just... It's not about...
It also seems a lot more designed for the scale at that point.
It does.
In terms of its white, you know, it's so open, just the white plains.
It's full of Zedoms, for driving skills.
For driving around at first, and then, you know, you're going to come back with the flight module later.
It's not about the mobility upgrade to go back to where I was trying to get to. It's about getting to see more of the world. Big chunks of the world, not just like... All right, now I can go through this door, or now I can climb up to this one ledge up there that I passed 20 minutes ago. It's about now I can go re-explore the entire game world in a new way.
Yeah,
you can see it differently, even just places you have seen before, see them differently, but then, of course, be able to see so much more that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, I mean, you can fly half a mile.
I mean, the context.
The air,
yeah. I think it's all about the context as well, just putting it in the context, the experience leading up to those moments.
Yeah, that moment that when you can first fly and they tell you, oh, go fly to that node, and you realize, oh, New LA exists in the game world because you fly over the wall.
Yep.
You don't have to.
Yeah, it's funny how it seems more, like we talked about with the man on ship, it seems more segmented than it is.
Right.
And then it's kind of like a weird, like almost a reveal, even though it isn't. No, it's all there. You know,
right. Kind of and to me, at that moment, like in my brain, I naturally thought, well, of course I can just fly over the wall. Why can't I? And it was after I did it, I went, wait, what did I just do? Oh, this is all together, because it always made you walk down that long tunnel.
Yeah,
it has the four, like all the different gates,
the sally port,
the different, but then, compass points.
I didn't stop. I just kept flying. Like, I just like, all right, well, let's see how far I can take this. And I reached Noctilum, and I'm like, this is all together.
Yep.
All right, let's keep flying. And I flew all the way to the Dragon's Roost on Noctilum, and then I got my shit kicked in. But I restarted the quest and then flew to the quest point and came back.
Yeah,
but
which is cool in itself because it's like way up, you know. Right. That's what I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the verticality of the environment.
Now, those moments of discovery with the verticality, you know, I mean, not just when you have the skelly, but like, I remember finding those sort of that weird kind of network of walkways that the Nopon have made in Noctilum and all that. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize they were there, and there's just this hall of a layer to that continent and all that. Like, those are really cool. Like, feeling like I've been here before and I didn't realize there was this other element to this environment, because it's just so dense and vast and all that you just didn't see it. There's just so much to see.
Noctilum especially, because that place, even late in the game, still feels the most scary.
Yeah, it's very
claustrophobic. It's dense, because like I said, that is more designed, even though, like you said, you could go anywhere, this, that, and the other. It is more designed of, like, this is the part of the game where you're not going to have a scale yet, you're on foot, so it's not that friendly to drive
it
around.
No, it's very difficult to use a scale in. And, I spent as little time in Noctilum as I could ever possibly manage. All right. Any more final thoughts?
If I were to give a final thought on it, I would say it's the kind of game where if you enjoy certain things like exploring and stuff like that, you will love it. And if you enjoy kind of crafting and gearing up your character, gearing up your skill, that kind of sort of min-maxing kind of thing, yeah, that whole kind of deal, you'll really, really enjoy it. But if you're looking for a more straight line story, deep story, you know, if you're more of a fan of stuff with no potato jokes, endless
beaten
potato jokes
into the ground.
Yes,
into the ground hard.
Jesus, yeah.
You mean like a potato?
Yeah. Yes, pomme de terre.
Oh, Greg. Yeah, like there are certain things I like. You will either love it or probably be slightly disappointed by this game, depending on what type of game you want to play or what type of game you want it to be.
Especially because the Wii U doesn't have that much in the RPG department.
Yeah.
I think people, you know, like the one email we discussed, you know, probably took it a bit harder than they might have done. And it was like, well, it's okay because there's like three other RPGs over here that give me what I want.
Yep.
Exactly. Right.
Here, Xenoblade has to be everything for everyone.
Yeah,
that's
a tough position to be in. You know, I knew it was going to be different from the original, from the Wii game, I should say, because like I said, they're not that closely related. And I knew that meant that certain things that I really liked about that game were going to go away. But then, you know, I wasn't too invested in the story in the first game. I kind of liked it, but no, I wasn't attached to it. I didn't demand a similar story or anything like that. So I was okay with it being a bit thin in that area, and just the exploration was what it was all about for me rather than the systems. I think I kind of, like I said, I got into the economy more than I thought I would, as far as the systems go, but not the gear grind stuff. That's kind of where I dropped out, where it kind of that in the post game becomes the most, prominent a part of it, I guess. But I said at the very beginning, I was very pleased with it, and I'll be interested to see what they do next, because I'm confident it won't be, I'm glad it was something different ultimately. You know, I have played Xenoblade on Wii already, so I was, and if these are only going to come along every so many years because they're such big undertakings, you know, I'm happy for them to be different, and hopefully, you know, next time it'll be something completely different again, even if it's going to be, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020 by then. Even
that's the thing, they own them though, so we're guaranteed to get them. That's what's great about it. I don't mind having a guaranteed monolith game like this every couple of years. That's fine with me.
Well, unless they decide that they're not worth the cost.
Oh, they naysayer. Developed so much middleware for Nintendo. Like, if you go read the credits of Wii U games, they're in all of them.
Yeah.
Right. Just very quickly, like, I know I've been probably the most negative on this game so far, but there are aspects of it that I like, the exploration, as everyone has mentioned, but that has to be qualified, right? Because, you know, like Zelda, A Link to the Past has exploration, you know, Etrian Odyssey has exploration. In this game, yes, it's like this open world exploration type thing where you can go anywhere, but you're going to be... you're going to have high level stuff that's going to kill you to block the road. And so that means that instead of opening up the world through developing certain skills or, you know, like in a Metroid style, like getting some upgrades to your mobility, that means that you're going to have to grind most of the time. So it's a very grind heavy game. And,
but you know, grind through quests though.
I didn't really do any explicit.
But the quests are not especially. They're not all. A lot of quests are kind of throwaway and grindy.
So Guillaume, you're like, you know, I know I've been negative on this game, but let me be positive moment while saying something negative.
What I haven't done is just pissed on it. So let me just do that.
Yeah. No, but like I was addicted to the kind of the loop of like trying to. Okay, I'm close to gaining a level here, and oh, I'm close to finishing this chapter, I'm close to getting this 10th bamboo stick to repair an espresso machine. You know, like I did get addicted to that.
Well, at least you're positive about how it sucks. That's good.
But yeah, as a warning, right. Like as you guys have said, like it's not going to be for
no me. It's definitely
no, I agree.
I'm just trying to state the reasons why someone might be turned off.
Yeah, I agree. Because from the point of view that, you know, like I said, for me, the biggest reward is seeing all these places. But, you know, it's not like you don't have to kind of pay your dues to do it. Even though we talk about it being open and all that. But, you know, there is
It is not the Pilot Wings, my dream Pilot Wing game that I described last episode.
Where you really are just kind of free to do the big two.
So would that game be called, like, Pilot Wings post-apocalypse, or what would you? I mean, it's not Resort, obviously, because
I'm curious as well.
Pilot Wings Refuge.
Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Oh.
Pilot Wings 4.
James would love that. Yeah, just bring a number in into it.
God damn it! All right. Just ruined it. All the negativity I could deal with, but numbering shit that's not numbered, that's too far, sir.
Pilot Wings Arcade.
What?
Deluxe.
A little bit of Pilot Wings on Mira from Xenoblade Chronicles. That's just the literal Japanese title translated by Yenoe.
Pilot Wings Training Resort. There. God. All right. So we had a lot to say about Xenoblade Chronicles X. We got a little rambly. Kind of expected that. It was okay. I want to thank these guys for putting up with the constant delays of this record being recorded and trying to scrape back into their memories to pull back this thing. Would have done it sooner, but we had other stuff to get through. It is what it is. I also want to thank everybody who wrote in, sent us emails. We got quite a few. Thanks to Guillaume for reminding me that we had more than I recalled. We just couldn't get to all of them. And I also wanted to thank the people who had expressed interest in guesting on this. There were quite a number of you, and we wanted to get our thoughts out there, and it would just be complete chaos to try to get everybody on. But, you know, we appreciate all the guests we have on the show. It gives us new people to talk to. It helps us fill slots. It just makes being the show a little bit more interesting every so often. We will, of course, be returning to our regularly scheduled programming next week with your new business and listener mail. So you could send your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I said it right this week, unlike last week, where it probably got edited, so I said it actually correctly. And on that, I think we're going to go ahead and end it. Our music for this week, Xenoblade, of course, but Xenoblade Chronicles X, to be specific, composed by Mr. Hiroyuki Sawano. John, if you would please. John.
What?
Oh, I was giving you an opening to at us.
Oh, okay, man. All right. Man. All right. Oh. Yeah. 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 There you go.
Normally, I don't have to prompt you. I just mentioned this game's music and you start ing in my general direction. I'm shocked that I had to actually say something.
I already got it out
of
my system earlier on before we were even on the air, so.
Well, save it for the show, John.
Save it for the show. I know, man. I know. I should know better.
our music for the end this week is the Silvalum Night theme. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
God damn it. We're going to go ahead and I guess, and we're going to call this episode
466.
466. Yes.
All right.
I had to think about it.
This is a train wreck already.
Yeah, it is not.
This is pretty. It is pretty, not a train pretty smooth wreck. Opening here. This is about
okay. So you've explained the concept of a spoiler. Can you now explain what a podcast is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's really get into this.
This is about as cold an opening as you can get.
I'm trying to keep it low key, because John, there may have been an episode that came out like 3 days before this that will also be called episode 466.
Okay, I didn't know that. I thought this was going to be canon.
Canon? Yes, this episode will be a canon. So
canonical.
This is
James.
This is,
come on.